This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We start the day today with an issue that we have been tracking throughout the pandemic, hunger and food insecurity. 1.6 million people in the Commonwealth report that they are now struggling to get enough to eat. That is an increase of 55% from 2019 to 2020. The data is from a new report by the Greater Boston Food Bank. It raises the count of those hungry in Massachusetts by 600,000 over a report that was released last November by a national hunger group. It also shows that people are reticent to get help, even where it's available. Joining us now, Catherine D'Amato, CEO of the Greater Boston Food Bank. Catherine, welcome.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Tiziana.
It's great to have you. Catherine, I'm going to start just by asking you, that total number, did it surprise you?
Yes, we were very surprised by it. It speaks just to the prevalence, right, of this issue, which I know you personally know very well, given some of your previous work, that, you know, we were looking, but we didn't expect to see the prevalence of food security so high, yet it makes sense given COVID and all of the factors, all of the consequences, all of the implications that families and individuals have found themselves in these last 12, 14 months.
So that suggests, listening to you there, Catherine, that this is not as straightforward as pandemic unemployment driving this change.
Yeah, well, we're really, you know, we understand that there are gaps and disparities in food assistance. And what we also learned a lot about beyond the one in three number, clearly just seeing that, you know, while one in three food insecure adults exist, they do use a pantry. But that surprised us, that why not more? And then the one in two food insecure adults enrolled in SNAP, why not more? Those were two very perplexing questions for us. But clearly COVID played a role in these significant historic numbers.
So let's stay with that. Do you have theories or hypotheses about what is making people reticent to access supports even when they're there?
Sure. I mean, we do understand that the barriers to food access, which were revealed in the report, I mean, they were clearly affirmed, but in a more significant way, that the desire to be self-reliant and the stigma, I mean, Tiziana, the stigma came through over and over again. The last one was the barriers about the misunderstanding of eligibility requirements. Now, we often think that the barriers to eligibility are related to federal programs. But what we found was there was confusion around eligibility to go to a pantry. And so that is something that we're going to need to do some very specific work on: education, promotion, helping people understand that these resources are here for them and that they can safely go to a food pantry. They can safely go to a meal program in order to get what they need.
Catherine, with those numbers, some of our listeners likely are also experiencing food insecurity. What are people's misperceptions about what they qualify for? And can you debunk some of that sort of specifically now? Is it around identification, paperwork, income levels?
Yeah, well, there are definitely, you know, I don't qualify, I work, you know, we've heard that before. I work, you know, or I own a home, or I'm able to, you know, pay most of my bills, but not all of my bills. Sometimes it can be fear, right? A fear if there's any issue around immigration, that I'm afraid if I go, they'll know. I mean, we saw that a lot with other federal programs as well. There also is some essence of, I don't want my neighbors to see me. I don't want my children to know. I don't, you know, I can provide for myself. That strength around self-reliance, you know, and to be able to, I should be able to take care of my family. When in fact, you can be two working adults, you know, making over $100,000, you could still be struggling in the greater Boston area, or you can be in Western Massachusetts or Central Mass and have inability in a car to get to a pantry if you live outside the cities. So this was just been able to help us really hone in and try to do better at understanding the why, Tiziana, and then be able to break those barriers down. I do want to note that the study did find disproportionate impact on people of color. You know, this is something we knew, but now we know. I mean, the power of being able to have, you know, data-driven insights into how we, you know, what is actually happening. So those numbers were also quite significant. You know, 58% of Latinx adults, 40% of Black adults, 20%, 26% of Asian adults, you know, were 24% of White adults. These were all, you know, disparities that existed before the pandemic, but now they are much more significant.
So how broad are the resources now, right now, for food insecurity in Massachusetts? And how do you think they stack up against the size of the problem as you've scoped it out here in this survey?
Well, that's, you know, our job is we've got to decrease the stigma around accessing food assistance and then decrease the inequities in food access. Those are two very clear recommendations that the report puts forward. You know, there's some programmatic ones. Tiziana, how do you focus on the awareness, engagement, equitable distribution? You know, there are significant resources in our state. Doesn't mean that everybody can get to them or that they're the right thing. But, you know, if you are listening or you need some assistance, you can go to gbfb.org/needfood. We'll do our best to get you connected to a local resource in your community that can be of direct help. Also, our Mass 211 is incredibly specific across the state. There are thousands and thousands of agencies listed. You just dial 211 and they will do their best to help you identify in your community, all 351 towns of Massachusetts. The last is we encourage people to seek out the Project Bread Food Source Hotline. It's an excellent resource. They can very quickly walk you through your eligibility for SNAP and for other federal nutrition programs. It's just families don't believe necessarily they're eligible. Why is my kids eligible to get a school lunch and a school breakfast, or I'm eligible for the WIC program? They may not even know there is a WIC program. So these are the programmatic recommendations that are available, and we'll be happy to make that available to you and your team so it can be posted on your website.
We will post it on the website. Thank you. That's Catherine D'Amato, CEO of the Greater Boston Food Bank. Catherine, thanks for the report, and thanks for talking with us about it today.
Tiziana, you're very welcome.
To mask or not to mask? It seems like the existential question since the CDC adjusted its outdoor mask guidance a week ago Tuesday, and then Governor Baker followed suit for last Friday. The town of Brookline most recently publicly played the role of Hamlet, deciding yesterday afternoon to lift its outdoor mask mandate after initially saying they'd keep it in place and after nationwide attention to their community debate. But it's not just Brookline. As policies change, as the science changes, and the gap grows between who feels safe and who doesn't, and which public signals we think we're supposed to send to each other, we are all trying to figure out how to be on the same page. And it appears that we are not. So let's talk about it. Pull up a chair to our virtual kitchen table and tell us what you think. What is safe with masks, with behaviors around those who are vaccinated, with reopening? What does it mean to you to follow the science? Do you think you are? Do you feel like others aren't? Join the conversation. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got two guests to chat with us. The first is Lenny Marcus, founding co-director of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative, which is a joint program of the Harvard Chan School of Public Health and the Kennedy School of Government. We also have Boston Globe columnist Beth Tytel, who has been analyzing our relationship with masks throughout the pandemic. Lenny Marcus, welcome.
Hello, Tiziana. Nice to be back with you.
Great to have you back. And Beth Tytel, great to have you back, too.
Glad to be back. Thank you.
So, Beth, I'll start with you. It happened so fast. You know, the change in outdoor mask mandates, it erupted into a fight like overnight. Are you surprised by that?
You're right. It was so fast. I guess it's not surprising. We've been fighting about masks the whole time. And I guess the only thing that changes is what the fight is. So, now, it's an interesting time because even though the governor, as you said, has loosened the outdoor mask mandate, when you walk around, everybody still has masks on. you can actually feel like you're doing the wrong thing. So many people are actually wearing masks, even though they don't think they need to, just because they don't want to look like they're a jerk. Basically, you have to wait till everybody accepts or understands the new mandate to stop wearing a mask, unless you want to look like a lot of people feel that fear that they'll look like a Trump supporter. So it's a super interesting time.
Yeah. So not only is it about sort of practices and guidance, but also appearances and what we think other people are. There's a lot of subtext to that, Beth.
Yes. I mean, I interviewed somebody who told me, sort of a public health expert who was saying that, and a human behavior expert who was saying that a norm got established, which was wearing a mask. And now that is the science has changed outside, but the norm hasn't kept up with the new rule. So the norm is sticky, he said. So everybody's sort of clinging to the old norm, even though the rules have changed.
I'm going to hang on to that framing. We'll probably come back to that rules versus norms, because that feels like a helpful way to think about this. Lenny Marcus, I want to turn to you. What do you think is at the heart of this fight? And if fight's not the right word, then struggle or tension or confusion, you know, feel free to pick your word of the day.
Well, Tiziana, it's very ambiguous. And when we think about masks, it's important to be looking at three variables. The first is viral load. How much of the virus does it take to transmit the disease? Mm-hmm. The second is air distribution. And if the air is moving around, you can't get that viral load. And the third thing is filtering. And if you're wearing a mask, or if someone around you is wearing a mask, you get that filtering. So it's those three elements that are critical in the decisions and the practices of masks. And I think that's where some of the ambiguity comes up in this very, very complex question.
And are you surprised by this struggle with the ambiguity?
No, because we got into COVID very, very quickly. Remember back in March 2020, all of a sudden we were all at home. So it happened very, very quickly. Getting out of COVID is happening in a very different way. It's slowly. It's not clear exactly what we should do, the norms and the rules. I think that's a good distinction. And so we can expect that there's going to be this kind of ambivalence and ambiguity as we move out of this, because it's been a very scary time and it's not clear how to move away from some of the restrictions that we've just become used to.
All right. So not surprisingly, the phones are just lighting up. So I'm going to turn to the calls here. 800-423-8255. Just pull up a chair to our table. Talk with us about this. How are you reacting to it? What's on your mind? Are you confused about the science? Do you disagree or agree with your community's practices? It's on the table. We've got David on the phone in Lexington. David, share your thoughts with us.
Hi, Tiziana. I was fully vaxxed almost a month ago, and I certainly haven't been wearing it outside since then. But I really, you know, most of my time out that I've been outside is running with my dog in a woodland where there aren't a lot of people, and I never wore it there. I mean, there's an infinitude of air, and you're zooming by people, and it's just seemed ridiculous. And the one time I did wear a mask outside was when last summer I went to Harvard Square just to see what it was like without any cars, and there were a lot of people, and so I wore the mask. But otherwise outside, I just haven't.
So appreciate that call, David. And I'm going to turn to another call here, but it makes me think of a piece by Shira Durone, who's one of the infectious disease doctors that often does Ask the Doctors for us in the Boston Globe today, where she talked about choices now being much more based on personal risk tolerance. Let's pick up one more call. We've got Jeffrey on the line in Brighton. Jeffrey, go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, everybody. The issue that we're having right now, and the reason why we're having this conversation right now, was because the United States has developed as we were. We didn't have the best administration prior to this, and it's sad that a year into something that has caused 500,000 people to die, that we're still questioning whether or not we want to save our lives. This is bad. This is not okay. I don't think it's fine that we are having this conversation still right now. I'm not trying to judge anybody or anything like that, but you would think that, you know, a little more sense of actually seeing death would just tell you, you know what, is this fake or not, man? Let me just save myself from whatever it is that's occurring. We're just throwing caution to the wind and going to, oh, is this person right or was that person right? If we had the right people speaking on the onset from the prior administration, right now, third world countries wouldn't do better than us right now. And that's all I want to say. Thank you for the time.
Jeffrey, thanks for the call. So Lenny Marcus, I'm going to turn to you on that one because you look at leadership, right? National Preparedness right. Leadership Initiative. Jeffrey's right. talking about leadership there.
So there certainly has been two very different styles of leadership in the prior administration and in the current administration, very different approaches to following the science. Without getting into partisan politics, I think this current administration is doing its best to inform people about what the science is, to base those decisions on the science, and then to explain why those decisions are being made. I think that kind of explanation has been very helpful to people as they make personal decisions, as David just said, about whether to wear the mask when he's out running or whether to wear the mask if he's in an outdoor area where there are a lot of other people in close proximity to one another. And I think the distinction that David made about two different ways of being outside is an important one for all of us to remember.
So I'm going to grab another call here, 800-423-8255. Jean's on the line in Wellesley. Jean, go ahead.
Hi, thanks a lot. I don't find the science to be that complicated. I'm as far as wearing a mask outdoors, I'm aware that it's okay now, but a lot of stores are not, and so I'll respect them, the outdoor stores like the garden nurseries. But what I am concerned about is, eventually, they're going to be opening up restaurants and letting us, telling people they can go in. And I probably will never go into a restaurant again unless they require people to have vaccination cards. Now, I'm vaccinated, but I'm aware that there are variants. I'm aware that it's not 100%. And I haven't heard anything about that yet, about the requiring of carrying cards.
So I appreciate that, Jean. There is some discussion at the state level on this. The governor has said that a vaccine mandate, which would require some kind of card probably, is not in his purview. There are members of the state, or is not his approach. There are members of the state legislature that have asked for clarification on that, assuming that that is potentially coming. President Biden has said he is not going to do that. I want to come back on all of this to you, Beth, because you brought up rules versus norms. And then Lenny, in engaging with the callers, added science. And we have a messy intersection between those three things, especially when a person's sense of personal safety, hey, what I'm willing to do is not necessarily consistent with what the science says it's safe to do.
Yes, I think that's a great point. Right, because right now the restaurants are open, but of course some people feel comfortable going in and some don't. Also, some people don't necessarily trust the CDC because I'm sure we'll all remember in the beginning we were told not to wear masks. So a lot of people say, well, now they're saying it's okay again not to wear them, but how can we trust that? And I think that just getting back to some confusion that people feel, you know, the mandate says, well, if you can, it's okay to go for a run by yourself or with members of your family or a walk. But the thing is, as long as you can socially distance. But I think then you think, well, how far do I need to be from somebody? Like if you're running, let's say along the Charles, you generally might not be that close to someone, but you might pass like within 2 or 3 feet, which I think I've heard is fine. You're not going to get it from someone just passing by. But a lot of people think, no, that's not okay. So I think it's very difficult. Like you're in a situation where if you have a mask and you're constantly putting it on and off. I think that's sort of what's leading to the confusion is that there's so many gradations of what's okay or what people consider okay.
Let's go back to the phones here, 800-423-8255 to join this conversation. We've got Sebu on the line in Sudbury. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Sebu. Thank you for pronouncing my name correctly. I think that was a great point that was made about the trust in the CDC because that message had changed from the onset. But really, I think that while there is so much science guiding coming down from, let's say, federal administration, I think that having some cohesion on even the state and local level would really help, you know, in the case of Brookline's example for folks. But I think that, and I'll end here, is that, you know, there is not enough science to really put a distance on how we should interact. And I think that outdoor spaces should remain really free. You know, I don't want to see us get into a society where the vaccination card gives you that, let's say, let's call it credibility. I am personally not comfortable with vaccinating yet. I'm almost 40. Thank you for the time.
Thank you for the call. Lenny, let me just, there's a lot there. So pick up on the thread that resonates with you the most.
Well, you know, Jean raised the concern about going into a restaurant with people who are not vaccinated. A team of us at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health worked on aviation public health and looked at how safe it is to be on an airplane, to walk through an airport. And 2 weeks ago, I testified to a Senate subcommittee on aviation, and I recommended that we do have some sort of a certified way of demonstrating that we're vaccinated. And if someone decides they don't want to get vaccinated, that they're able to show that they have a negative COVID test. And one of our colleagues at the School of Public Health, Michael Minna, has been advocating a low-cost, highly reliable, efficient testing that can be done in the moment very, very quickly. So that before you get into the airport, even before you get to security, before you get to boarding, you show either a negative COVID test if you don't want to get vaccinated, or you show that you've been vaccinated. So imagine that scenario where you're going through the airport, you're on the plane, and you know that the chance of someone with COVID in the environment is very, very low. I think if we combine some sort of certification for vaccination with low-cost tests for COVID, we could evolve to the point where there are very, very few people circulating in the population who are transmitting the disease. That's something that's within our reach in this country and something from a policy perspective that I'm advocating.
So, Beth, in listening to Lenny there, I'm thinking, so that's a plan to get to an end. And it's more of a focus on means that get us to an end, which is minimal circulation of the virus so that people are safe and so that we don't have the spread of variants. It made me wonder, are we overly focused on pushing people about the means versus creating, and this is a legitimate question, versus creating a suite of options that our rules and our norms can guide around and that are rooted in science, but where the focus becomes the ends and less judgment with each other about which means we use to get there?
You know, that's so well put. It probably is the only way we're going to get out of it, to say, however, right, if you don't feel comfortable, you don't want to get vaccinated, you can't because of a medical reason, that's fine. But here's what you can do then to be able to participate in things in society that you want to. So as you said, you make the goal, what the activity the person can do, and however they're going to get there, that's actually fine. I think so many people, though, are so traumatized that it takes a while for that to end. Like, you can't just turn it off right away. So I think the more things that can happen to make people feel comfortable in open spaces or in closed spaces, the better off we'll all be.
Let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255, to join the conversation. Let's go to Susan in Andover. Susan, what's on your mind?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought they were going to play the initial recording. I have had lifelong allergies, and there were lots of times in life when I really should have been wearing a mask, didn't, and needless to say, recent years, compliance has been enforced. Anyway, I'm concerned that for people like myself, or anyone for that matter, who chooses to continue to wear a mask, that they not have to worry about being bullied or, you know, subject to nasty comments. And I guess, you know, I feel that way because even though currently our political climate is once again feeling comfortable, it's hard to, certainly for someone my age, which is, well, we'll just say it's a year that kind of blows.
We'll skip that part for you. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. But it's a big one. And just in the past few presidential elections, you know, the incredible political the climate and what made climate allowable and all of that has kind of turned on a dime, you know?
Yep. Susan, I'm going to take it back from you there. Thank you. Because there's a couple of pieces we can pick up in what you had to say. And I want to do them one at a time. So the first is, I wear a mask because it's safe for me. I should have been wearing one before. Now our culture authorizes me to. I don't want us to go back to a point where it doesn't authorize me to anymore. Why are we worried about shaming and bullying, Lenny? And why is that in the mix? And maybe you'll say it's because of the second part of Susan's call, which was about the political climate.
Well, you know, we're working with state health officials from around the country. So Alaska, Illinois, Texas. And what we are hearing is that we have different mini cultures in each of these states. So the attitudes that we have here in Massachusetts about masking are very, very different than what you see in Alaska and Texas, for example, and of course, what we know in Florida. So to go to Susan's question, it's highly likely that we're going to see people wearing masks here in Massachusetts for some time, if not forever, during flu season, during allergy season, and it will be acceptable. And, you know, to pick up on what Jeffrey said earlier, there's different political currents in each of the states across the country, and those political currents could very well translate into tolerance and acceptance for the fact that people at various times are going to want to continue wearing masks.
So I am thinking again, Beth, about Jeffrey's call. He was our second caller, expressing what I took as some real frustration that people aren't willing to take steps to keep other people safe. And then I think about all the articles I read in preparation for today that said, you know, but why should I do something that seems like it's going to keep people safe, except we know it's not necessary to keep people safe. And that feels like the rock and the hard place that we're in our norms right now. And I wonder, in talking to people about this and thinking about this, what is our path to shared commitment to keep ourselves and each other safe, and therefore not judging people who are not making extra signals to do that if it's not necessary in order to keep someone else or ourselves safe? Was that too complicated, or is my question clear? I was kind of thinking as I went there.
Yeah, no, I think it's very clear. I think you've raised the very interesting question of doing something just even though you know it's not, even though you know what you want to do isn't harmful, but doing something else so that the other people around you feel safe. I mean, I'm sure we've all had times where you're driving and then someone's crossing the street and you really want to let them know, I'm not in any hurry. So just take as long as you want. So I will even just wait until like they're really on the sidewalk, way past my car, just so they don't have that second of feeling like, oh, I need to hurry. And I think that same thing is sort of true with a mask. In other words, okay, I know I don't need to wear a mask because I'm 10 feet from you, but I'll do it to make you feel comfortable. But then the problem is a lot of people, the masks are super annoying to wear. So that's sort of where it gets in. It's like my mask stops at your nose or something along those lines. I guess ideally the virus will be so low, the numbers circulating will be so low that people will start to feel more comfortable, even the people who are like a little bit extra nervous if others don't have a mask on, you know, and that are close to them.
All right, let's get one last call in here quickly. Danny in Norwood, go ahead, quickly.
Yeah, so really quickly, you know, I've heard people say they're nervous about getting the vaccine. I've heard that woman say that she's afraid to actually enter the restaurant unless everyone is vaccinated. And so for me, if we go to that woman's route, it's really prioritizing her fears over other people who maybe are afraid or a little bit hesitant to get the vaccine. It's prioritizing one group's fears over another's, and that's kind of my problem with this debate and when people say everyone needs to be vaccinated.
So prioritizing those who are afraid of the illness versus those who are afraid of the vaccine. Is that what you're saying, Danny?
That's right.
Thanks. So last thought on that before we close, Lenny Marcus.
You know, a number of years ago, we studied Boston right after the Boston Marathon bombings. And it was remarkable how this community came together, how the leaders of the different agencies came together. And we identified what we call swarm leadership, this notion that we're all in it together. Remember how people in Watertown helped out during that day when there were the house-to-house searches, that we were all there for one another. We call that the swarm. And I'm hoping, and I think it's certainly possible here in Massachusetts, that we'll bring that same kind of swarm mentality and swarm spirit to getting beyond the disease, at least for those of us living here in Massachusetts.
All right, we will leave it there. Lenny Marcus, founding co-director of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative, which is a joint program of the Harvard Chan School of Public Health and the Kennedy School of Government, and the Boston Globe columnist, Beth Tytel. Lenny, Beth, thanks to both of you. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Boston prides itself on being prosperous and progressive. So why are white people the ones disproportionately prospering? And what barriers to prosperity does the city put before Black Bostonians? Those are questions at the center of a new documentary film, A Reckoning in Boston. The film is streaming as part of the Independent Film Festival Boston from Friday until Sunday. And joining us now to talk more about it are Coffee Dixon, who is a producer and whose story is one of those told through the film, and filmmaker James Rutenbeck. Coffee, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And James, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So, Coffee, I'm going to start with you. The film follows you on your quest to start a farm in Boston. And folks listening out there haven't had a chance to see the film. So I want them to understand it's not just a quest. It's a saga. It's an odyssey. Let's go back to the beginning of it. When did you first decide that this was something that you wanted to do? And how did you start?
I was a business owner here in Boston. I had opened a produce market called Milk and Honey Produce Market. And because of politics within themselves, that produce market in Ashmont Station, Dorchester, was closed down. And I started thinking about what my safety and my life and my well-being in Boston looked like and what it looked like for other women of color. And I decided to, leave Boston and go to Vermont to start a rural farming enterprise. But in looking at my privilege and being able to say I'm ready to leave as a working class woman in Boston, I realized that a lot of women who I grew up with and were friends with and in my community did not have that same privilege. I then started thinking of creating something for them here in Boston and providing them access to urban farming in the spirit of what the Menino administration thought it would be for communities in the allowance of Article 89 zoning for urban farming here in Boston. I just began to bring the women together.
We're going to talk more about what unfolded after that and sort of how you talk about what safety is in the film, Coffee, but I want to bring James's voice in here for a minute. James, Coffee's journey is riveting, but it's not necessarily what you started out with when you set out to make a documentary, is it?
No, not at all. I started out in 2014 at Codman Square Health Center, where the Clemente Course in the Humanities takes place. That's a tuition-free night course in the humanities. It's a rigorous course that's free for community members. It's taught by professors from Harvard, Boston College. It's a rigorous course, and students who get through it get 6 credits from Bard College. I had heard a Clemente graduate speak at a benefit dinner, a Mass Humanities benefit dinner, and was very moved by what she said about her experience there and how it led to this new life trajectory for her. And at the time I thought, well, this could be, you know, really compelling possibly film idea. So in 2014, I met Jack Chang, who's the director of the Dorchester Clemente course. There are 34 Clemente courses in sites all over the United States. But Dorchester was close to me. I live in the western suburbs. I know a lot of filmmakers in Boston. And I thought a kind of collaboration to tell the story of this experience of transformation through engagement with art, history, literature, and philosophy could make for a really interesting nonfiction film.
So how did you settle on telling this story of Coffee trying to bring Black women to the land and land to Black women for ownership and safety and food growth?
Right. So I always thought that the film would need some kind of context. Like the Clemente students bring their life experience and lived experience into these really interesting conversations about Socrates and about, you know, Picasso. And so it's not like an undergraduate college, it's a whole different kind of learning experience. And I thought that that piece would be enough, but I always knew that the film would need a kind of context about the lives of the students. And so I started spending some time with two of the students, Coffee and Carl Chandler, who's another character in the film, and got to know them. And the more time I spent with them, the more compelling I found their stories, and the more I wanted to incorporate their life experience into the film itself. And that's what sort of led to these complications, at least for me as a filmmaker, because I realized at a certain point, as I witnessed evictions, housing court, welfare agencies, the day-to-day obstacles and the chaos and calm persistence of the lives of these people, that as a white guy from the suburbs, I was not really equipped to mediate their stories. And so at a certain point, we shifted a bit and pivoted, and I brought Coffee and Carl in as producers with me contractually, with a share in the film revenues, because I felt I was spending so much time with them and had become so dependent on their counsel to really understand their stories that it was sort of, you know, it was ethically the right thing to do. There was a sort of a third piece that happened later too.
So let me bring back Coffee, and then we'll work in that third piece, because Coffee, there's a million questions I want to ask you. I want to know, once you became a producer, does this film tell your story? Is this the story about you want told, and what do you think that story is?
The story is a story. It's not just my story. And I'm thankful for that. And it wasn't just Carl's story. It's a story of a community of African-American and Indigenous people who's rarely seen their experiences, although maybe documented in research or in, you know, Boston indicator statistics or in the healthcare field as far as morbidity and mortality. And in the Race in Boston series, it hasn't been visually documented, right? So in working with James, the story is not just of my story, it's the experiences of an African-American community, Black and Brown folks here in what we believe is a progressive city, right? And I believe that story is told accurately, that James was able to be a neutral witness and to tell the story and to support us in helping not just him, but the audience around the subject matters.
I'm gonna stay with you now for a minute. As I began to really feel like I was getting to know you in the film, it was when you started talking about your history with Thompson Island and Boston Harbor. Here's a little bit of how you describe it in the film.
So, I have nobody to talk to. And I'm always going back to this place called Thompson's Island.
Definitely that and some other experiences are why I always go to land for peace. Like, you literally went out there and felt safe. And my big thing was the healing power of safe spaces.
So then you take this vacant piece of land and a group of other Black and Brown women, and you begin to work that land. It belongs to the city. You begin to work it, and you try to get the city to authorize it and give you legit sort of permanent access, and it is just roadblock after roadblock. So was your city saying, we don't want you to feel safe? We don't want to give you the healing power of a safe space?
You know, a lot of this documentary is fascinating because it's not necessarily about racism. That is a pillar in the systemic and structural violence that we experience. But a lot of it is really about what's going on nationally, which is misunderstanding the voices of Black and Brown people and their needs, right? Either marginalizing those voices or using a power and privilege or heroicism to decide that a community that is not of that socioeconomic community, that race, that culture, can better define and design our communities. The interesting thing about talking about safe space and me with Tolga constantly referencing when we felt safe is
Tolga being another woman, excuse me, Tolga being another woman in the documentary who's a longtime friend of yours. Sorry, go
ahead. Yeah. You know, I talk about in trying to look for understanding or explain, you know, what it was for safe space for us, what I was trying to do by not asking the city initially for land, but taking land, not for myself, but for the women, right? Because my vision was to go to Vermont or Western Mass and take my savings and buy land and farm as an experienced farmer, as a rural farmer, right? But I was trying to create safe space for them where I knew I could find it, but I didn't know in the oppression that Black women experience in Boston if they could find it for themselves. So I came in as an advocate and shared experiences. And it was challenging. And it had been challenging, and James experienced those challenges, and a lot of people who were not women of color, who were not impoverished, you know, who did not understand the intersectionality of being a Black woman. The saga began to explain to them or try to justify why we needed safe space. And to be vulnerable, not just to the camera, but to, you know, the powers that be about what violence looks like to us, what the murders of our sons, our daughters, our children's fathers, our husbands, the incarceration of ourselves, our bodies, and the bodies of men, the socioeconomic class, the lack of in inclusive integration into, you know, economic development, business development, neighborhood development, right? As individuals, how all of that violence demanded, at least in my perspective, a need for safe space for women who are like me.
I'm going to turn back to you now, James, in hearing Coffee talk about the experiences of Black women. You also have Carl Chandler as the other story that you tell. Carl is a Black man, and at one point he is facing eviction. Here is a little bit of Carl talking about that after he was told by his landlord that she wanted to sell his building and he would be facing eviction. Here we go.
My landlady said, you've been a great tenant. You know, everything that a tenant is supposed to do, you've done. I want to sell. And I said, okay, well, how much time? And she said, well, 2-3 days. And I'm thinking, this is a nightmare.
Mm-hmm. And James, it's one of many times in the story where you are confronted with the reality that Coffee, that Carl, that Tolga, that others just have the rug pulled out under them or are just stopped in their tracks in ways that you never are. And excuse me, I do want to go back. The producers are reminding me that Carl identifies as Black, Indigenous American, and Western European. I want to be respectful of how Carl self-identifies. You learn your own lesson about their experience in this community and yours.
Yeah, definitely. What I really learned was, you know, as a suburban white man living in the suburbs, just 8 miles from Coffee and Carl, there's really like a parallel society in a way. And there's so much that is hidden from people like me. Like we don't, like the chaos of housing court, for example, like that's something that I had never seen before. You know, there were dozens of families there, mostly people of color with no legal support to speak of, who were facing eviction. And I saw it at the welfare agency with coffee, when there were women there who were trying to learn how to be their own paralegals in a way, and just to figure out how the system could work for them, because they were facing losing Section 8 certificates. And all this, you know, I began to understand my privilege. And part of privilege is being protected from all of that. And not only not experiencing it, but not even having to see it or witness it. And I think that was the turning point for me, because I had developed a relationship at this point, after 5+ years of filmmaking, with Coffee and Carl, and we are friends. And when you see your friends put into these kinds of situations, it requires a response. I could no longer just be the observational filmmaker. I realized that I had some skin in the game, and I had to be part of it. I was part of the story as well.
So Coffee, I'm going to come to you now, and I'm mindful of time. We'll only have a moment for you to answer. But we fast forward. You have the land now. You're farming it. Do you feel... Go ahead.
Go finish your question. I'm sorry.
Well, do you feel safe? And do the women who are working with you feel safe? And again, just a sentence or two. I'm sorry that we're out of time.
No problem. Not necessarily. We still don't have equity in this land. We are developing. We are doing community design. But we're still raising funds. We're still searching for co-op solidarity members to our co-op. And we're still looking for that to make this project foundational, to own the land, so that we can so that the space can continue to exist past my time here in this community. It's the start, right? But we still have a long way to go to talk about safety for the majority of Black and Brown women here in our city.
That is Coffee Dixon and James Rutenbeck, producer and filmmaker on A Reckoning in Boston, which is streaming as part of the Independent Film Festival Boston from Friday until Sunday. Thank you so much to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tatiana. Thank you so much.
Folks, that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thanks for listening. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.